Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at MormonStories.org.
Welcome back, Mormon Stories listeners. We're moving into a second segment here with Jim McLaughlin. I trust that you've all enjoyed the first section where we got to know his life and certainly the beginnings of his philosophical worldview. And I thought it was a beautiful way that he closed with a testimony of sorts. And I definitely want to move towards that again by the end of this. I'd forgotten to mention, actually, Jim might be familiar to some of you for another reason, and that was from a 2007 Sunstone presentation that he did with Tom Kimball of Signature Books, and it was called Do You Have a Testimony Of... And it was basically Tom and Jim discussing about how two people who've kind of looked at the same questions have decided differently on the ability to say yes to temple recommend questions. And so I definitely want to move into that towards the end. But for now, Jim, if you don't mind, I'd love to just lead us into a couple of areas of your philosophy that I find fascinating. And that would be the materials that you wrestled with in your dissertation and simply that whole desire to be God stuff. And then after that, I want to talk with you about one of the favorite articles and the themes of that article that I ever published at Sunstone was working with you on this sort of idea of the Mormon God who is in the fray, who is in it with us instead of being above it, and sort of it's a real distinction between Mormon theology and perhaps what we would consider classic Christian, Judeo-Christian theology. So those are the areas I want to cover. Does that feel good to you?
Yeah, sounds great.
Okay, so lead us into, if you were to encapsulate your desire to be God thesis and sort of how that flavors your life and your approach in Mormonism and things like that, please dive in.
Okay, well, one of the most famous lines in Sartre, and it's the one that most people would have heard, is from his play No Exit, where the character Garcin, who's in hell with these two other characters, says, "Hell is other people." And it's other people because of what Sartre thought was the basic human condition, which he described as the desire to be God. Now, you know, for a Mormon, you know, just that idea of the desire to be God, you know, I remember reading this on my mission and then in graduate school and thinking, wow, you know, somebody else is thinking about the desire to be God. But for him, it's a negative thing. It's our desire to have our will worked in the world. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, you know, think about being a little kid and you've just seen Rambo on TV. And you imagine yourself Rambo-esque. You know, you're really, you know, tough. You go out there. Because these are, you know, all these, you know, like action films are male fantasies of, you know, being God. You know, you go out there and the world is there for you. When I was a kid, you know, it was James Bond because, you know, James Bond never died and could seduce any possible woman. I mean, they were all, you know, just putty in his hands. So you go out, though, and so you have this desire for your will to you know, be worked in the world. Like, I remember, you know, one of the reasons I got a PhD in philosophy was that as growing up through elementary school and junior high especially, it was until my senior year that I even thought I was even going to go to college, that I thought I was stupid. And, or, you know, some of my teachers did. Some of them didn't. Some of them said I was smart but lazy. But I remember thinking, if I got a PhD and became a college professor, then I would know I was smart. Now, Sartre, of course, says none of this works because, you know, you get a PhD and you meet all these stupid people who have PhDs or all these college professors who are idiots, even though they're nice people. But, you know, there is no guarantee that you can pull this kind of thing off, this project, he calls it, that you can finish it. And one of the big reasons you can't finish it is because hell is other people. Now, what he means by that is, say, okay, let's go back to being Rambo in the playground. The bully comes up and kicks your ass and says, "You're not Rambo, you're Pee-wee Herman." So you become suddenly aware that your project is doomed to frustration. But you also become aware of what Sartre called the other. And this, you know, in philosophical terms, there's always, all going back to the philosopher Descartes, there's this problem of other minds. You know, how do I know this is all just not my experience? Or if you go back to the Mark Twain story, remember, it was all your dream. Well, Sartre says, no, because we are immediately aware of the presence of the other, because they frustrate our desires. And, you know, there are all sorts of really complicated phenomenological, philosophical explanations of this experience, of the experience of the other. But we have this sense that the other frustrates all our desires. And, you know, I remember reading this and thinking, wow, you know, that's Cain in the Book of Moses. You know, why does he kill Abel? Well, you know, I have learned the great secret that I can murder to get gain. You know, it's you know, this desire to be God, and what's in our way? Well, other people are in our way. Or if you go to King Benjamin's discourse, and you know, the natural man is an enemy to God. Why? Because he wants to be God, but to be God in this evil sense of wanting to control the universe. Or Lucifer during the war, you know, in the war in heaven. I want to control everyone else's freedom. It's this incredibly negative idea of being omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent, which just happens to be the way most people think about God. Okay.
Yeah, very interesting.
So, you know, Mark Twain's right in this sense that this idea of God is of the supreme jerk who rules the universe. And that just struck me as, you know, incredibly powerful. There were other philosophical reasons for thinking about things this way. But, you know, as we know, Sartre's an atheist, and there's no way out of this for him. But I was also, at the same time, reading Nikolai Berdyaev, the Russian philosopher, Friedrich Schelling, a German philosopher, and Jakob Berma, 17th century German mystic, who, you know, that article was partially on him. But right. Berma has this wonderful line in, I think it's 6 Theosophic Points, where he says, basically, hell is the place where you blame everyone else for your being there. You know, it's a place totally without love, it's a place where there's only self-love, I guess you could say. But we all have, you know, and that's basically what Sartre said when he said, hell is other people. They frustrate my desire to control the universe, and I find that hellish. And so how do we, you know, Sartre himself spent the rest of his life after being a nothingness trying to figure out how we get out of this mess. He promised the next book was supposed to be about ethics, and that was going to show us the way out. And he famously never got it done. But, you know, I think that other philosophers have done it. I think it's in Mormonism about how to do it. And, you know, I guess that's what we should sort of come to now.
Dive in. One of the things that, when you mentioned all the different examples of blaming everybody else, stuff like that, I don't know if you've read C.S. Lewis's The Great Divorce.
Yeah.
But the description of hell as, it's just this, I don't want to be in relation with anyone else. And so he talks about hell expanding out and out and out, and people abandoning the center of town where they have to deal with other people, until eventually it's just this pure isolationism, because that's the only way that you know, they can find sort of peace, is to not be in relationship with anybody else.
Yeah, there are places where this idea pops up in literature all over. You know, it's in Brothers Karamazov when Grushenka tells the story of the onion. But if you've ever read Michael Ende's The Neverending Story, I'm not talking about the movies, but the children's book, The Neverending Story, Balthazar Bux ends up in something like just what you've described, the city of the emperors, lost emperors or something, last emperors, where he has become so obsessed with his own power that he's completely out of touch with anybody else. And he, kind of like John A. Whitstow and Brigham Young describe, is in danger of disintegrating into nothingness.
Very interesting.
Turning back to element. Because to exist is always exist in sociality. It's to exist in relation to other people. Even, you know, and I think for Mormons, we want to get into this, start getting into this now. It's to be is to be in relation, and that's true even for God, not just for us. God doesn't exist out there in eternity outside the world. God is in here with us. One of the philosophers who fascinates me is the French Jewish philosopher Emmanuel Levinas, who, like Sartre, talks about how we encounter the other person as opposing our will. But for Levinas, he sees this as the beginning of ethics, as the beginning of language, as the beginning of everything important about what it is to be a human being, to encounter this opposition in the face of another person, and this tremendous sense of obligation as well. And that's, you know, if we go back to King Benjamin, those chapters, you know, we one of the bad things about having verses is we quote them and then we forget how they relate to the rest of the what's going on. And so you have in chapter 3:19, the natural man is an enemy to God and has been since the beginning unless he yield to the enticings of the Spirit. And then the next chapter, we have the rich man who has his chance to yield to the enticings of the Spirit. The poor man is asked for his help, and he says, as being an enemy to God, he says, you've brought this on yourself. You know? And Benjamin says, no, this guy has to repent because, you know, he's, you know, that's where he's encountering God right there, you know, in relation to that human being who's asking his help. And that's when Benjamin says as well, when you're in the service of your fellow man, you're only in the service of your God. This is incredibly wonderful stuff. And I think it connects the Book of Mormon to King Follett. You know, some people have claimed that Joseph Smith's theology has changed radically by the time he gets to Nauvoo. Well, it's developed, but you see how it could all work together if you think of it in, I think, these terms.
Right, and then certainly things like Alma 42 about God ceasing to be God and all that, that's all in the Book of Mormon that, you know, like you say, it develops.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the that's an incredibly radical idea, you know, that if God were, you know, I remember, you know, this is one of, I go back to my biography a minute. I remember sitting in ninth grade seminary and them trying to explain this mercy justice thing. And the way it was explained, and then my seminary teacher was a good guy, but the way it was explained, it made absolutely no sense to me at all. You know, why can't mercy rob justice? Well, if God was a good guy, he'd let it rob. You know, but, you know, I mean, the resources are there in the tradition for it to be, it's easy, it could be easily explained by the fact that God can't, you know, that soul that we, that what is it, that song, know this, that every soul is free, that God can force no man to heaven, because then he becomes Satan. He ceases to be God. You know? So, and we have this idea that, wow, you know, God could cease to be God if he was, if he did these kind of jerky things. So it's I think you find this stuff back there, and you don't have to look at Joseph Smith as a kind of traditional Christian in the Book of Mormon, and then a radical Promethean in the King Follett discourse. Yeah, you can see that there are connections that go all through it.
Yeah, cool. Well, for those who listen to me on Mormon Matters, they know that I'm totally into pushing the unique or the different flavors of Mormonism. As for whatever you think of Joseph Smith, he's proposed some interesting things about the universe. He's hit on some sensibilities that I find really attractive. So I love where we're headed with this. So I'm going to push you. Can we go right into sort of that material on, and again, I don't want to disparage traditional Christianity. I don't want to, you know, I know that there's historical reasons, and like you say, there's many wonderful people that believe these things and, you know, would argue with us. But I would still love for you to lay out that distinction between the Platonic ideal of a God that's, you know, everywhere and unpassable and all that stuff versus the Mormon God that's in the fray. What Gene England eventually kind of, towards the end of his life, one of his final essays was the weeping God of Mormonism. Yeah. You know, yeah. So I'd love to play in that field for a while, if you don't mind.
I'd like to start out with a quote from one of my favorite American philosophers, a guy named Edgar Sheffield Brightman, who probably nobody has heard of. But Sterling McMurrin liked him quite a bit. He was a personalist. As a matter of fact, he was Martin Luther King's mentor at Boston University. He died a year after King got there, but King was always heavily influenced by Brightman's philosophy. And in the 20s, Brightman wrote a book called The Problem of God, and he said the title had a triple meaning, and I think this is just, you know, wonderfully Mormon, that God is a problem for us, that we are a problem for him, and strange as it may sound, that God is a problem to himself. the idea that if we go back to 2 Nephi chapter 2, that opposition in all things goes all the way down, even into God, is, I think, a really powerful notion in Mormonism. And solves a lot of, we get different theological questions that come up because of it, but solves a lot of the traditional theological questions, especially dealing with the problem of evil. And the difference being that the West has adopted, and I love Plato, okay? I think Plato is a fascinating person to read, but the kind of Platonic version of perfection that comes from Plato and the Greeks is the ideal of an unchanging perfection that exists outside of space and time, that somehow eternity, in the sense of not the way Mormons think about eternity as endless time, but in the sense of perfect being, never changing, is basically the Platonic idea of perfection. I mean, if you go to Florence and you look at that wonderful statue by Michelangelo of David, and you wonder, you know, like if I were an alien and I didn't know, and I'd popped down from the planet Zebox or Kolob, and I didn't know who the heck this thing was, but I had read the biblical story, I don't think I would ever connect the statue to the David in the Bible. Because what we encounter there, because Michelangelo is a wonderful Christian Platonist, is this idea of human perfection imitating the divine perfection. And the individual, but the individuality of it, besides it being an individual statue, the imperfections, you might say, the things, the accidents, the things that make it David an individual, are all kind of washed out. This is the ideal human body. I think, you know, going back to Sartre's desire to be God, this is why Salt Lake City leads the world in plastic surgery, because we've come convinced that we have to be perfect in the sense of not having any face.
Any individual, yeah.
All individuality has to be completely washed out.
Wow, interesting.
Like this ideal. And, you know, this gets Christianized by early Christian theologians like St. Augustine, who, you know, once again, Augustine, one of the greatest minds in the history of Western thought. But it allows him to talk about eternity. Let's see, I've got a quote here from Augustine, in the sense of God is sitting there in eternity and he's looking at the whole of the painting, the whole of creation as a painting. If you remember that old Bette Midler song, God is watching from a distance. And he sees that it's all good. You know, we so much of this language is in just our everyday parlance. It's all good. God is watching from a distance. It's all part of God's purpose. And so if we look at the painting, and I use this sometimes when I'm talking to my philosophy of art students, if the painting were completely white, you know, no dark spots in it, it would be incredibly boring. But if the painting, you know, were filled with contrasts of light and dark, of thunder and lightning and all these kind of things, then it's an interesting painting. And so Augustine says at one point, we are like people ignorant of a painting who complain that the colors are not beautiful everywhere in the picture, but the artist has laid on the appropriate tint to every spot. Now, that's one way of approaching the problem of evil, that, you know, everything is God's in his heaven and all's well on earth, that hell exists because, you know, you got to put the evil people somewhere and that's where they are. And, you know, you get this sense of, you know, from God's point of view, it's all good. If you're stuck in one of the dark spots of the painting, you just should, you know, kind of kick back and say, well, you know, I'm playing my part. Now, that's what Mark Twain when he says, you know, Mal's forgiveness and invented hell, Mal's golden rules and invented hell. That's what he means, that we have a being who exists in eternity, who is changeless, who is perfect in that cold marble sense of David is perfect, and created a world that has this horrible suffering in it, but somehow from his point of view, it's all good. That there's something really horrible about that. That, you know, another wonderful example of this is at the end of the Divine Comedy. You know, we've gone through hell, and, you know, and we get up to paradise, and Dante meets Beatrice. It just sounds so much cooler. And
Beatrice, come on!
And he... You know, she takes him to the beatific vision, and they stop looking at each other, and they look at God. Yeah, it's like, you know, I've never met God, you know, and this is going back to my own spiritual experiences. I haven't met God that way, and I'd be very suspicious of it if I did, because, you know, it could just be a projection of my own desire. But I've met my wife, and I've met, you know, Frère Bourdin in France, and I've met, I can't even remember the name of the Marxist I knew in France, and I've met my father, and I've met my dog. And, you know, and I feel kind of more compelled by them than I do by, you know, something that strikes me as a philosophical and religious fantasy.
Interesting.
And not, maybe not a very good one.
Right. Now, one quick clarification, these are the philosophical implications of the God in traditional Christian group. Not everyone is pushing it this thing. They're not thinking this and saying, "I prefer this." It's probably just more in the level of an unexamined sort of.
Well, we like to believe that there is this all-powerful being who's going, and we all love to believe it. This is what I believed when I was hoping for the revolution to happen, that this event or this person is going to come down and set everything right and do it all for us. And it's like, have you ever seen Annie Hall, Woody Allen's Annie Hall?
Yeah, I have.
You remember he's in a conversation. He's standing in a movie theater, and he's arguing with a guy about Marshall McLuhan. He said, the guy's saying, "Look, I teach a class on this at Columbia. I ought to know what I'm talking about." And at that moment, Woody Allen pulls Marshall McLuhan from out behind an advertisement, you know, a poster. And Marshall McLuhan says to the guy, "You obviously don't understand what I'm talking about." You know? And
right. It's
resolved the argument. And we all, I think, one of the real attractions of creedal and traditional theism is that idea that, you know, this being is going to appear and tell the Republicans they're wrong, or tell the Democrats they're wrong, or, you know, in the really bad versions of this, wipe them all out and kill them all, even the horses they came in on, if you read the Left Behind series. What'd the horses do? I love horses. Or if you read Tertullian, you know, he's going to shove them down to hell, and you and me, because they tortured us, are going to be sitting up there in heaven kind of grooving on the whole thing of them being tortured in hell. You know, wouldn't that be a great place to sit there and stare at Glenn Beck down there burning forever? but, you know, there's something really sick about that way of looking at the world.
Exactly. But it all comes out of a desire, like you say, for security, that this is, it's going to be made right.
It's going to be made, it's security, it's power, it's, and I think it's something we have to be very suspicious of. And if I sound like an atheist here, you know, attacking religion from, you know, Dawkins' point of view or things like that, Levinas once said, and Berdyaev did too, that atheism is an important moment because it's in a moment of asserting a kind of independence from this other. But it's a moment, and it's a moment that we need to move through towards something better. We have to move from a kind of innocence of the Garden of Eden, where we're together with God but don't exist as ourselves, to rebellion, I guess, in one way to talk it, but to at least alienation from the other, where we discover ourselves. But then the next moment, I think, is to answer the call of the other, of God and of other human beings and animals, and enter into a kind of community with them again. And I think this is what Section 130 of the Doctrine and Covenants is saying when it talks about the kind of sociality that we have here, but haven't fully realized yet, and that's what we should work for, and that's what we'll hopefully get to in the next life.
Wonderful. Take us down. Okay, so let's say the worldview that you've talked about, the Platonic ideal and unchanging and a God out of space and time, that's there. People don't push it. People don't push our Mormon starting points the way we do it. So do that for us, if you don't mind taking us and, you know, really make vivid, if you can, the difference in Mormonism that, again, is there, but a lot of us don't go exploring.
Well, you know, there's a wonderful couple of pages in the middle of Richard Bushman's author's diary that I'm going to make a plug for Coford Press here. They published I can't even remember the title of the book, but it's an author's diary, On the Road with Joseph Smith, that's it.
Right, it's the year after Rough Stone Rolling came in out, and he's basically keeping a diary of his travels and the conversations he has with people as he promotes that book.
Right in the middle of it, I can tell you the pages. Pages about 60 to 63. And then, so everybody should buy this book and go out and read this part. Bushman talks about what he thinks Mormon theology is. And it's basically, you know, he talks about, you know, the gods, plural, out there calling us to be like them. And I think the idea of calling here is important, calling us to be like them, to exist in a fuller, richer existence. And we have the choice whether we're going to do it or not. And, you know, he tries to lay this out, and, you know, it's just a couple of pages, and he's just beginning to think about this. But at one point he says, you know, of course, this has been de-emphasized in the church. And he talks about President Hinckley in his famous interview with Mike Wallace saying, we don't know much about that. You know, even though if you go back and you look at King Follett and you look at Brigham Young and Penrose, you know, it's all over the place. But he says, well, you know, maybe it makes sense to de-emphasize this as the church expands, but it would be a horrible thing to lose it. It's an important cultural resource. And I think he's really right about that. At the beginning of this, I said, I don't believe there is a Mormon theology. I think there are about 30 of them. We're trying to make sense of things. And so that's that, back to Bergson again, that's that open and closed source. You need them both. And so as we go back to this particular interpretation of the scriptures and of King Follett, and I know my friend Blake Osler sort of agrees but sort of doesn't agree with me, or, you know, Bob Millett wouldn't agree with me at all, but the idea here, and what I find so compelling about it, so about this particular Mormon idea of God, which I think is the right one,
of course,
is that God is involved with this in this with us. That wonderful passage from 2 Nephi, chapter 2, that there is opposition in all things, goes all the way down even into God. What God's been around longer, or I should say the gods. I like that idea. I like to think of them as God is an ancestor just further back. You know, do your genealogy and you don't connect your... Well, I like Brigham Young on that too. But anyway, but you go back far enough, you know, in your celestial genealogy and you get to God. And Mrs. God, of course, too. They're both there because that's what it is to be a god. And it's not just them, it's the whole family back there. It's the whole council. And they're involved in this. They handle the opposition better than you and I do. The opposition is this tension between the community and the individual. At least that's one way to look at it. There are more oppositions than that. But one of the central ones is between the community and the individual, because there are rewards and dangers by losing the balance between those. Berdyaev talks about two things. One he calls freedom from, and the other he calls freedom for.
Right.
The freedom from is the freedom from restraint. The freedom to do what you, as an individual want to become. This, by its nature, is going to alienate us from others, at least somewhat. The temptation toward evil there is to become demonic in the sense of, what we were talking about with C.S. Lewis and Michael Ende's Neverending Story, that we become so individual that we deny our relation with everyone else. And Brigham Young said, if this would happen, we would just cease to exist, because the reality of the world is to exist in relation with everyone else. I could go on like this for hours. But
I love that stuff too. Yeah.
Yeah. Hegel talks about this. He says, he calls it spirit. And he says, think about this. Did you create your language? Absolutely not. But it doesn't exist out there like a Platonic ideal. It's changing all the time. We are both creating it and created by it. And it's a community, it's a relation to a community that happens. But it's only what makes a community? A whole bunch of individuals. So the evil from excess individualism is this freedom, an excess of freedom from, is exemplified, I think, in people like Korihor, I look at as the John Galt of the Book of Mormon.
Fun.
Well, Ayn Rand was smart enough. I think she's a grade D-minus philosopher, but she's smart enough to realize that what she's doing has nothing to do with Christianity. And it would be good if Mormons could realize that too. But this idea that you can do this by yourself, that's evil. Okay. So the other side, we have freedom for, which is the freedom to create Zion, where we come together and we seek to create this community together. But there's a temptation to evil here too. And it's another way of dissolving the self, but we dissolve into the mass. And this is what, certain spiritual experiences, I think, are dangerous this way. Like I remember as a kid growing up and going to testimony meetings, but people would be just kind of overcome by a feeling of emotion. And Herman Melville describes this in Moby Dick, in the moment when everybody is squeezing the fat, and they're all squeezing the fat together from, melding down the blubber from the whales, and they have all these wonderful thoughts. But it's complete fake, they end up at the end, getting everybody killed. But the self is lost in this kind of, common feeling. And you get that in Nuremberg rallies where everybody gets together and Zeke Hiles. And so often those are constructed too as either these incredibly vague things or either these things that we set ourselves up against another group, Hitler against the Jews, Tea Partiers against liberal socialists, liberal socialists against Tea Partiers. Woody Guthrie used to talk about this, blacks against the whites, browns against the yellows, polka dots against the plaids. But we lose ourselves and we become these ciphers that don't allow us to see in the face of another person, because they're different than our group, the divinity that's there. Or don't allow us to see individual wonder that's in the other. And somehow we have to learn, and I think that if you study the scriptures here, we have to learn to balance these things. And that brings us into the higher unity, which is Zion or sociality. I always love this quote from the Hindu philosopher Ramanuja, who after Shankara had said, the truth is the one, that you real is to be absorbed into the one, to lose your individuality in oneness. And, Charles Hartshorne used to point this out, but there's no difference between pantheism and theism here. God's everything for the theist, and the one's everything, or Nirguna Brahman's everything for the pantheist. But what Ramanuja says is, in order for there to be loved, there has to be a lover and a beloved. There has to be at least two. We have to have this plurality. And, God can't be God without us. So that's, and Joseph Smith I remember reading your dissertation, and there's that you quote that wonderful line that God in the King Follett discourse, where Joseph says, "God," and maybe you can quote this for me if I get it wrong, "finding himself amongst other beings like himself, desired that they should be more like him," or something like that.
Finding himself in the midst of spirits and glory, saw fit to institute laws, etc., where they could become more like him.
That's beautiful. You got it. And that I think is, for me, the most powerful idea in Mormonism, and the most beautiful.
I agree. And I want to make this stuff come alive a little bit more. And you are so amazingly well-read, both in literature, but also in film. Would you do some of your kind of draw these things in more concrete ways through Groundhog Day, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon,
Wings of Desire,
yeah, the early version of the City of Angels or whatever, yeah. So just riff if you would, because I just think you just do such a great job of nailing these things down in sort of plot lines and sensibilities that we all have. Yes, this is the better way, and yet so many of us don't examine that there's a real difference in philosophy at play.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I saw Groundhog's Day back in the 90s when it came out, and I loved it, and it was, I thought it was a cool movie. And then I was reading this kind of crazy Croatian philosopher, Slavoj Žižek. Yeah. I love the German idealist, romantic Friedrich von Schelling. And he had written this book on Schelling called The Irreducible Remainder, which is an incredibly interesting idea. And if we get to talk about free will, maybe it's something that I'd like to bring up. But anyway, at one point, Žižek, who talks about pop culture a lot, brings up Groundhog's Day. And it was one of these moments where my eyes were opened. And where he says, if you think about it, Bill Murray is a bad case of the desire to be God. He is sitting there. He starts out, remember, before he gets stuck in the time loop that keeps him in, I can never say the name of the Potoxonomy, Pennsylvania. Somebody can say this. On Groundhog's Day. And what Žižek says, he's in eternity. And he's in an eternity without relation to others, because he sees them. At first he sees, and he even says he thinks he's a god. He sees himself as kind of controlling this thing, and he does certain things like seducing women and robbing banks, because there's no consequences to it. He's in eternity. But eventually he realizes he's in hell, that because nothing happens. It's just this constant eternal return of the same. It's in a bad sense. He's just going around and around in circles. Aristotle said that the perfect form was a circle, but we know in reality that nothing works that way. But but what happens, he says, this is the Schellingian element of the film, is he falls in love. He falls in love with, Bill Murray falls in love with the Andy McDowell character, and when he actually really does get to the point where he really loves her, he gets out. And he leaves eternity in this bad sense for time. But, if you watch the film carefully, too, it's not just him that her that he falls in love with. He falls in love with the whole town.
Right.
He loves everyone there. And that breaks the bad eternity that he's in. This hell is other people thing. That breaks it, and he gets into relation with others. And when you're in relation with others, either God or us, theologically, that brings change. Because it's like being in a conversation. I have to react to you. I got a quote from Schelling here that I love, where he says, God can only reveal himself in what is like him, in free beings acting on their own, for whose being there is no ground other than God, but who are as God is. Now, this next sentence is really interesting. He says, he speaks and they are there. Now, usually the way we would theologically read that traditionally is God speaks and the world comes into existence. But what Schelling means here when he says he speaks and they are there, to speak, to say something, is to assume the existence of another, someone who you speak to. And so in a real sense, God becomes God because he has another to whom he speaks. or she speaks, or they speak. But to be is to be in relation with others. And, you know, so, you know, I can't talk about love unless I think about my wife. We can't talk unless, you know, you, Dan Witherspoon, whose name I finally said right after almost 15 years of knowing you,
I wouldn't have thought you knew it was me if you didn't say it wrong for so long. So, anyway.
If I wasn't talking to someone, and there's this, you know, this sense of, you know, if you're going to have love, you've got to have others. And you have to, and others implies change, because in any conversation, if bad idea of a conversation is the one that we all get into when we get into debate, we stop listening to the other and we're just thinking about what we're going to say. But the real conversation is to, you know, actually react to the changing world that we're in.
Yeah, it's genuine risk.
Yeah, genuine risk. And that's what I think God's up to. Now, somebody might object and say, well, gee, how are you going to finally win this, you know, and bring about Zion and bring about, you know, paradise? And, well, you know, God's always on the job. He's never going to quit. You know, even those folks that are down in hell, he's trying to talk them into coming back, but, you know, they probably won't do it. but, you know, this is why I love, you know, the early Talmage version of Articles of Faith, where you get progression between kingdoms, because this job is never finished. Constantly working at creating Zion, or Brigham Young. So I've got some wonderful favorite quotes from Brigham Young, but the idea, you know, that if they send us to hell, we'll irrigate it, you know, and we'll create heaven of hell. Or, you know, and this goes down, this makes Mormonism so much more interesting. Like, there's a wonderful quote from Brigham where he says, I've got to get back to more movies, but he says, if he's speaking in the 1850s, and he says, you know, if the Book of Mormon was translated now, it would be translated differently than it is. Isn't that cool?
Very cool.
I mean, that, you know, because times have changed in a sense, there would be things that certainly we could find consistencies. And, you know, when I see passages where the Lord says, I am the same yesterday, today, and forever, it's not that I'm this changeless rock that just sits here. It's that I will love you. I will be on the job. I am committed to you forever. I will, you know, you are engraven on the hands of my, on my hands. Can a, you know, a mother forget its suckling child? It's the commitments we make when we marry each other in the temple, or, you know, that, hey, I'm going to love you. I'm going to love you more, actually, in 20 years than I do now.
Awesome.
So it's, you know, it's, you know, those are, I think, wonderful things. But now back to the movies. Okay, so Groundhog's Day, and consider, you get this wonderful line in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, where, you know, you have the two characters played by Cho Yun-fat and Michelle Yao, and Cho Yun-fat is a Buddhist monk who, you know, practices incredible kung fu, and is...
In slow motion.
In slow motion, yeah, and flies. And yep. He's trying to save, I can't remember the name of the character, who is in danger of becoming evil, and from the Jade Fox. But he gets, the Jade Fox tries to kill her, and he gets hit by one of the darts. If you haven't seen the movie, go see the movie. And he gets hit by one of the darts, and he pulls the dart out, and he's been poisoned, and he's going to die. Unless they can, you know, get this antidote, which, you know, they have to run away for. But he sits there at the end of the film with Michelle Yao, and they're talking. And she says to him, hold your breath. And you know these two people are in love, even though they've never even touched each other. She says to him, hold your breath for your meditation that you can enter, so that you can enter nirvana. Don't waste your last breath. And, I mean, this is one of the great romantic lines in the history of film. He says, I've wasted my whole life. I would rather, and he tells her finally that he loves her. And he says, I should have the quote in front of me, but I don't. He says, I would rather wander by your side eternally as a hungry ghost than enter paradise without you. Wow, you know, I wish I could come up with lines like that and say to my wife. You know, it's, it, it, yeah, it's Because, I mean, if you've seen any J-horror, you know what being a hungry ghost is. It's not nice. You know? But it's this just incredible idea that, you know, yes, being attached to some things. You know, as we know, Buddhism, you know, wonderful it is. And there are types of Buddhism I think are actually quite like things in Mormonism, and we should be dialoguing with these people, but that's another discussion. But
well, Sharon Adams is doing it, and yeah. So there are some people doing it, and I agree with you; it's fantastic.
But that idea that here, you know, that goes against the basic Buddhist notion of not being attached to anything. But there are certain things. John Cobb talks about this in his dialogues with Buddhism in Beyond Dialogue. But there are certain. And Christ in a pluralistic world. But there are certain things that are worth being attached to, that you should be attached to. You know, that if you're not attached to them, you're in trouble. You know, and that seems to be what's going on there. The last film that I, and there are more films, we could talk about lots of films, but the last film that really strikes me this way is Wim Wenders' really wonderful 1980s movie, Wings of Desire, that gets remade into an American version, which I've actually never seen, City of Angels, with Nicolas Cage and Meg Ryan.
And it is a terrific film, and I know the themes that you're going to talk about here really are in it as well. But yet, okay. But I saw both of them, and I saw why you'd prefer this one.
The German one is amazing. It's one of the most amazing films I've ever seen, it's Bruno Ganz, who later gets to play Hitler in Downfall, but he's younger and more handsome in this one. But he's an angel, and the angels watch they're in Berlin, and they're watching over people. They're chronicling everything that happens, and the angels are always in eternity, so they're in black and white. And there's some wonderful links here to The Wizard of Oz, by the way. But the angels are always in black and white, and they're watching from eternity. But he falls in love with this woman who's a trapeze performer. And he's pulled by this into the world. And when he enters a world of color, of suffering, and of change. And of, as you pointed out, real risk. But and what's so funny about it, too, is he is so cool when he's an angel. But when he becomes human, he just looks so uncool. You know, which was awful. I think Wenders, I'm sure Wenders does this on purpose, but she has dreamed about this guy. And finally they meet in a bar at the end of the film. And she doesn't let him speak, but she gives one of the most beautiful speeches. The dialogue for this film was written by Anke, the German poet. She gives one of the most beautiful speeches in film. But basically what she says is, now life has become serious. I have come to a point where I'm making a commitment. You know, he's making this commitment to this other person. It's not just, as we go back to Groundhog Day, it's not just this fantasy in my head. It's not just this idea that I'm entering some eternal, unchanging perfection. No, I'm meeting this person who is wonderful for the fact that they're not me, they're different than me, that they stink sometimes, you know, they have body odor, that they contradict the things I say, that they, you know, that they're capable of doing all these things, but also at the same time capable of doing something, of freely responding to me and telling me that they love me. And this is how life becomes serious. You know, and this is because, you know, you think about what friendship is, and what love is, and this is what it is. And when the Lord, both in the Bible and in our scriptures, talks about us as His friends, you know, that's far better than being His subject, because to be a friend is to be in this relation with God.
Yeah,
and you know, I think it's evident in the Book of Mormon. Well, evident in the scriptures, if you look at something like, you know, you take our idea that Jehovah is Christ, the God of who created under the direction and along with Michael. It's done in council, and the women should get mentioned, but, you know, this comes out of a patriarchal tradition. So, like Brigham Young said, if it was translated today, it'd be different. Okay.
Very cool.
But, you know, when you read the Book of Job and you listen to God's response to Job, and you think, this is completely unsatisfactory. God has got problems here, you know? Now, there's two ways of reading that. One is that God's just saying, look how cool I am, I create everything. The other is Brightman's way of reading it, is God saying, hey, man, this is a mess, I'm doing the best I can, which I find a little more sympathetic. But still, you know, it's a very, I think, unsatisfactory response to Job. But then you look at Book of Mormon, I think it's Alma chapter 7, verses 11 and 12, where it talks about Christ will come down and, you know, suffer the pains and suffering of all human beings, that he may learn to succor his children, you know? Hey, there are certain things about experience in the body that you just can't get theoretically.
Exactly.
And then you go forward to section 122 of the Doctrine and Covenants, which is another response to Job type thing, but much more understanding. Much more, you know, hey, I was kind of a jerk to Job, but but I know how it is. And just hang in there, you know, we'll get through this and it'll be for your good. So it's you know, you have that kind of development, I think, right in our scripture that is just a better way to look at our relationship with God and our relationship with each other.
I love it, man. Great stuff. And this is the kind of stuff that always intrigues me, and this is, I don't know, I just always just put it at the level of an intuition, a sensibility about the world that I think that Joseph Smith hit on. I don't know that he fully understood it himself. He couldn't wax as eloquent as you on you know, how this distinguishes from other things.
He was,
but
pretty eloquent, eh?
Well,
he was powerful present. But yeah, go ahead.
No, I just like give the guy some credit for coming at the world in a different way, and these are the kinds of ideas that keep me around, definitely. Besides those other things of the sociality and the positive freedoms for of what I want to try to accomplish in the world through other people, you know, with other people.
Well, and yeah, this is go to this notion, you know, often why we stay in the church. And Gene England talked about this when he said the church is as true as the gospel. Because if you think about the gospel merely as this kind of Platonic idea, it's pretty worthless. It's something that you have to, it becomes helpful when we actually exist with it in the world with other people. And I remember years ago reading Peggy Fletcher Stack's piece in Sunstone, talking about her journey and the joys of being in a ward with people that don't politically or theologically agree with you.
Yep.
You know, like in Wings of Desire, you know, that's what serious life is having to figure out how to live with these people. And even better than that, having to figure out how to love them. And Tom Kimball is such a beautiful guy. He wrote a piece in Sunstone a few years ago where he described, Tom's such a down-to-earth guy, fixing somebody's roof in the war.
Right.
And showing up, you know, Woody Allen used to say 80% of anything is just showing up. Showing up and doing something like that is, I think, more important than sitting around doing theology. But doing theology is important because it gives us the tools to help us to show up. Okay?
I like it.
Because if I hadn't done this stuff, I couldn't go home teaching, you know, because I'd run into all these people that watch Glenn Beck and listen to Rush Limbaugh and think, man, I don't need this. I'm just going to go hang out with the folks that watch Democracy Now. So, you know, but to meet real people is to, you know, realize that, yeah, we got to live with these guys. You know, and then when we stop living with them, we have something like the Civil War happen.
Wow.
And that's why I think all Mormons should read Lincoln's Second Inaugural over and over again, too. Everybody should.
No kidding. That is, every time I go to Washington, D.C., I start bawling when I read that on the wall. Yep. Amazing. Hey, I want to bring it home, and you mentioned Tom Kimball, so this is a good segment. John DeLynn will often take, you know, guests on Mormon Stories, and he'll you know, ask them pointed questions about, you know, you're aware of all these difficulties, how do you handle them? And and I know that when he interviewed me, he says, you know, how is it that you
I remember that.
Yeah, for him it's like, how can you handle with integrity the different questions of the Temple Recommend interview where you need to assert certain things? And you and Tom, as I mentioned, in 2007 had this wonderful session where the two of you each talked about why your integrity takes you in different directions on that particular Can I Answer Temple Recommend interviews and not feel false. And I'd just love it if you would take us home, and I'm sure this will tie back towards the end of our first segment about how your approach to, I thought it was just gorgeous, you know. And I don't really want to get into the difficult issues or anything, but I will let people know that you certainly are as aware of anybody else about all the stuff that doesn't add up.
Yeah,
but
I'm an
yet,
amateur.
But you're still there. Yeah.
Like so many of us, I'm an amateur Mormon historian. I know that there are many dark spots in the painting, but that makes Mormonism so much more interesting than if it was what we were told in seminary. And you know, this is just one thing. One of the things I'm thankful about in my life now is the thing that I thought I was cursed with when I went on my mission. I believe that I was not a very spiritual person, and I still believe that I'm not, and I actually am happy about that. You know, in that wondered, you know, why can't I believe this stuff? And but then, you know, later when I got in, you know, when I decided what it, sort of that I believed, and I love this passage from Brigham Young where he says you only have to believe what's true, you know. So when I first encountered the dark spots in Mormon history, I don't think it hurt me as much as it did some people who have, you know, were so committed to the whole thing. I know my wife Carrie had a hard time because as we discovered these things, they hurt her more than they did me because, you know, I hadn't been that committed as a youth as she was. But anyway, get to the Temple Recommend interview, and I. You're going to have to help me remember the question.
Well, don't worry about it. To me, it's more just the approach of you're aware of all of these things, and yet you still affirm the reality of the resurrection. Those kinds of different things.
I have what...
Say resurrection? I meant restoration.
resurrection works too.
Yeah, no kidding. You're right. Yeah, so, hello. Go.
What I did with Tom was I tried to emphasize, and we had been talking about this quite a while. Like I say, Tom is one of the most wonderful people I know. And what I tried to talk about was what I call the minimum and maximum. There's the minimum that I think is necessary for me to believe and accept to go on. And then there's the maximum, which is what I hope for. And if we consider things like, let me say the Book of Mormon. I spent a long time in a kind of the middle period of my life in the church, reading things from farms and reading things against farms, trying to make up my mind whether the Book of Mormon was an ancient document or a 19th century document. And since I got to admit, you know, since I love the 19th century, all my interests in philosophy are in the 19th and early 20th century, so... You know, so I see those elements in there. But finally, I came to the point where I just said, this is while I was teaching institute and seminary here as a volunteer here in, I'm in Cullowhee, North Carolina. I'm at the only state university in the country that doesn't have a town. We are rural. If you've seen Deliverance, you've seen where I am. Okay? I'm literally, you know, they film part of it here. Okay. But, And I finally came to the opinion that it doesn't matter. It's nice to believe that it's ancient, but it's the truths of the Book of Mormon, the more important ones are if you can, you know, and William James helps me on this, if you can put together a way to live, you know, and in a way, I don't want to sound like the guys from South Park in the Book of Mormon musical, but because it has to be more than that, but the minimum is that believing that God has revealed this truth in a way that we can build a community together that will help us to build Zion. That's the minimum. The maximum is that there's a guy named Nephi in heaven, and I'm going to meet him someday. And I really hope that's true. And I will be overjoyed if I get to heaven and I run into Nephi and he says, hi, yeah, I'm really here. And, you know, that will be the coolest thing that ever happened. But if I run into if I get to heaven and there isn't any Nephi around, I'm not going to be that disappointed. I want to be, you know, my dad will be there and that'll be even great. That'll be better. You know, but I feel this way about everything. You know, that if you take the truths of the restoration, whether or not Joseph Smith was chasing around 14-year-old girls, these ideas are wonderful. And let me read a quote here. You've heard this quote before.
But, not the idea of chasing 14-year-old girls wonderful, but you're saying these broader truths that come through
Joseph
Smith. Broader
truths, right. Okay. Well, not a good idea. Right. Telling Kimball's daughter, you know, that if she didn't marry him, her family was going to hell. Now, that was definitely bad. Okay. He's going to have to do some time for that. God, you know, is always on the job. But here it is. Where is it? Okay. One of my favorite Mormons was William H. Chamberlain, who was the first Mormon to study philosophy formally. He worked with two of my other favorite American philosophers, George Olmsted Howison and Josiah Royce. But he said this. This was printed in the BYU newspaper when he was teaching down there. It's called A Christmas Sentiment. But there's this quote in there that I find just incredibly compelling. Where he says, for reasons like these, I am thankful for nothing as I am for the place in the midst of a chosen people of the Lord for service. Now, notice that. Chosen people of the Lord for service. You're not chosen people of the Lord, you know, because you're so great. You're chosen to actually get out and work. It says, as life unfolds, my own desires and efforts are sanctified by the memories of my parents and grandparents and their struggles for the cause of Zion. And so it is with all of us. Now listen to this. Even if Mormonism were not true, inspired by our love for our fathers, we could make the cause they loved true and bend it to the service of our God, for his work in this world is infinite and he yearns for our cooperation. And he goes on to talk about how God can't do this alone. Now, if you look at that, you know, and I read this once at a conference in a particularly, you know, well-known Mormon guy got up and got irate at me for it. But if you look at it and you see what he's saying, he's not saying Mormonism isn't true. But what more important than, you know, the mere historical stories that we tell each other to help us to understand how God is working in the world is the idea that even if it weren't true, inspired by our love of our fathers, we could make the cause they love true. We could bend it to the servants of our God, that he yearns for our cooperation. That what they did, and I was particularly impressed a couple of years ago by one of John's guests, whose name I can't remember now, who talked about how much he loved 19th century Mormonism. What they did was to create a society that's still with us. That, you know, people will always say, oh, the law of consecration didn't work because we weren't holy enough to live it, or the, you know, united order was an ideal that we can't live by. And I remember this brother saying, well, you know, just because it's an ideal doesn't mean we shouldn't try to live by it. We don't junk the law of chastity because nobody can quite figure that one out. But actually, when you look at it, you know, we do still live by these laws. You know, we're asked to do them in the temple, to covenant to them. And, you know, when my neighbors showed up and moved me, they were living that law. You know, the church is involved in humanitarian work in a big way now. They don't talk about it much, and that's good too. And I remember, you know, after Proposition 8, a wonderful quote by one of the people from the gay community said, you know, I don't hate Mormons. I just wish they'd get back to what they're good at, disaster relief. And that was such a beautiful thing to say, because that is what we're good at. You know, we're the best when we're doing that kind of work. And that's what Chamberlain's talking about here is, you know, that's what the restoration is about. It restores these glorious ideas of our interdependence with each other and of the divinity in every human being. And then, so in a sense, that would be the minimum that I think, the most wonderful part that we have to believe in. Now, if it happened, I really hope it happened all the way Joseph Smith said it did, that the, you know, that John the Baptist came down in the Susquehanna River and then Peter, James, and John and all that stuff. But, you know, if it wasn't quite like that, I'm cool. You know, because, you know, I still have this wonderful group of people who I can work with to try and help make the world a little better. And if same thing, you know, when we talk about, you know, belief in the resurrection, well, you know, the temple question, you know, asking whether President Monson holds all the keys and everything. Well, of course he does. He's, you know, he's running this organization. That's the minimum. If it means what, you know, what my bishop means when he says it, that's the maximum, you know, and I would hope for that. But the, what was I going to say here? I just went blank. But this idea of this kind of cooperation goes forward to our notion of the resurrection, I think, as well, you know, that we believe in Christ's atonement. And if you think about the what's wonderful about this, on the, even on the minimal level, Christ calls us to sacrifice our own selfishness in love for others. He calls us to love our enemies. You know, the other thing I used to read over and over again was the Sermon on the Mount. Both versions. I liked Luke's because, you know, the poor were the good people and the rich were the bad people. but
you Marxist. Yeah.
I love Marx. Okay. But the like I say, I'm a wannabe Marxist, so I don't do enough. But those ideas of this kind of self-sacrifice, I think it, on a minimal level, you know, if there isn't life beyond this one, it's still a better way to live. But we can hope for a life beyond this. And it's not, you know, and what I was talking to Carrie about this, and she said the same thing. I have had so far a wonderful life. You know, I met Carrie. I've got to, you know, I teach at a, you know, regional state university, which, you know, isn't research university heaven, but it's a wonderful place. I have wonderful students. I get to think about this kind of junk all the time. How many people have done that in the history of the world? Early Mormons used to do that, and they were farmers. But so if I died and I, you know, there wasn't anything else, yeah, you know, I've had a good run. It wouldn't be bad. But on the other hand, there have been a whole lot of people who life has been absolutely horrible to. And if they died and there's nothing else, the universe is a real shitty hole. You know, I can't describe how much I would hate the place. And so I, William James talks about this in The Will to Believe. I have to believe. There's a moral, I think, imperative to believe that there is something beyond this life that we are working toward. And, you know, the other thing, if my dad doesn't exist anymore, the universe has got something seriously wrong with it. And so I feel like the minimum idea here is that I believe in life beyond this life because I think I'm morally compelled to believe it. The maximum, though, is that I have, even though I, as I say, I don't believe I am a very spiritual person in the sense of, you know, meeting folks on the other side and stuff, but I have people that I have loved, you know, this is the empirical part, who I trust, who have had experiences that I know can be explained in reductionist ways, you know, in materialist ways. But they are the most real experiences that these people have had, and I choose to believe them. And so I think that, you know, the Zion concept is building Zion here and perfecting it finally on the other side. Anyway.
Thank you so much, Jim. I, you know, there's a part of me that wants to say, you know, how do you handle the statements that you have to believe it all or nothing? You know, it's sort of these, you know, it's all true or it's all false. If this false,
well, you know, that's the thing with Brigham Young too. He says you only have to believe the true part. So I can believe what they're saying insofar as it's true.
Okay, that's good. And how did you evolve to that perspective? Is it simply at a certain point you began to trust your own intuition, your own deep contemplation on it over something like that that could be interpreted, at least the way I do it, as more political rhetoric to rally the troops, to shore up?
Yeah.
Is that, that I guess that process, I think, is something that a lot of Mormon Stories listeners, I think, are, you know, we're in the middle of that process of saying, I'll trust my own gut when they say this.
Well, when I didn't get hit by the truck, you know, back when I was on my mission, and I said, I told God, you know, okay, I'll wait. You know, life is short. I am never going to figure it all out. But I can hope that eventually, you know, as Paul says, you know, when we get through this, we see through a glass but darkly now, but then face to face. Isn't that interesting? He says face to face. You know, we're going to encounter the other face to face. So, you know, I think it's a question. Now, I don't blame people who leave the church, you know, because I was close to leaving it several times myself. But you're leaving something wonderful if you do. And there are ways you're going to have to figure out how to live this, you know, in ways that you can feel that you're being honest. And I think that if we study the history of the church and the statements of general authorities, so many of them that contradict each other in some ways, that there we have to realize that that puts us in that opposition of all things and that struggle to try and figure out what is most important and how can we live through this? You know, how can we and continue to create something like Zion, a world or a community worth fit for human beings to live in. And you know, the for me, you know, to leave the church, and I know people leave it for other groups, but to wander off by yourself renders you less effective in doing that. Now, I'm sure that there are many listeners who would think, no, things are so incredibly repressive that just sitting in church and, you know, occasionally saying something, you know, I am really rendering myself incredibly ineffective. I should be out working in things that actually work. Yeah, I can see that. But then you were giving up the church to, you know, the church was so beautiful and we're going to give it up to Glenn Beck. I can't do that.
Wow, Jim, this has been a couple of hours well spent, and I'm so thankful to you for coming on. Just the neat circumstances of you and I talking, and then I'm going, hitting myself over the head saying, why have I not thought to make sure that Jim McLaughlin becomes a friend to so many more and known to so many more, because I just have loved our friendship. I'm always inspired by it, and I have a gut feeling that this is going to become a favorite podcast for many of our listeners. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you. And I just want to thank both you and John for doing this, because Carrie and I listen to the podcasts and we really enjoy them. They've been really helpful to us in, thinking about some of these issues that you guys discuss. And it's just been a pleasure doing this. And knowing you for the last 15 years has been one of the great things in my life, you know, because we're both process theologians, and it's just fun to have another one around.
Well, you know, it's so funny. I was thinking beforehand, you and I will have to be careful not to talk too much inside baseball on things like that. So maybe sometime we ought to do like a side series, Mormon Stories for the Philosophy Nerds, and then we can really go into all that stuff. So if enough people in the comment section here call for that, maybe we can do it and clearly delineate or differentiate this from a normal Mormon Stories. And then you and I and maybe a few other people can start riffing heavy on consequent nature, primordial nature of God, and all the other whitehead and different things that we're nerds about. So, but thank you. I just thought today was wonderful and down to earth and practical, and I'm going to go ahead and link to that article in Sunstone that I've loved so much, and people can get a little bit more into the issues that you raised through the movies and God in time and outside of time and different things. And there's some really powerful stuff there, again, like you hinted at, but about what really it is Satan's plan to want to be away from other people and to want to control it all and to isolate and stuff. So
they're really wonderful resources in this whole tradition of philosophy. It hasn't been the A tradition, the majority position, but it's been out there since the beginning. And my crusade is to try and make Mormons more aware of it. But there's this whole tradition running from that you find it even in the Middle Ages, but I think especially running from Jakob Verma to the German Romantics to some of the existentialists, to the process theologians, to American idealists and American pragmatists that Mormons really, really ought to study.
I mean, exactly.
And I think it would be helpful to them.
Awesome. Well, Jim, thank you for your generous spirit and spending the time with us. And if I can engage you, I'll let you know when this thing posts. And if you don't mind visiting the blog from time to time and responding to comments, I know that people will really enjoy that.
Okay, thanks a lot, Dan.
Thank you. Take care, my friend.
Goodbye.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. 'Tis better far for us to strive our useless cares from us to drive, to the sand joy your hearts will swell. Journey's through.